you've noticed the teepees on the lawn of the Nelson, announcing the museum's current exhibit of art by Plains Indians. As part of that exhibit, a film series explores portrayals of American Indian characters in the movies, from old silent films like Daughter of the Dawn to contemporary satires. How has a century of cinema shaped popular perceptions of American Indians? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the big question on today's Central Standard. Plus, this week's Tell KCUR segment gets into our listeners' wackiest sports superstitions as the Royals continue to advance in the playoffs. Stay tuned.
You know, Thomas, I don't know what you're talking about half the time. Why is that?
I don't know.
I mean, you just go on and on talking about nothing. Why can't you have a normal conversation? You're always trying to sound like some damn medicine man or something. I mean, how many times have you seen Dances with Wolves? 100, 200? Oh, jeez. You have seen it that many times, haven't you?
It's a great question. How many depictions have we seen of American Indians in film, Dances with Wolves or otherwise?
Don't you even know how to be a real Indian?
I guess not.
No wonder, jeez. I guess I'll have to teach you then, ain't it? First of all, quit grinning like an idiot. Indians ain't supposed to smile like that. Get stoic. You gotta look mean or people won't respect you. White people will run all over you if you don't look mean. You gotta look like a warrior. You gotta look like you just came back from killing a buffalo.
But our tribe never hunted buffalo. We were fishermen.
What? You want to look like you just came back from catching a fish? This ain't Dances with Salmon, you know. Thomas, you gotta look like a warrior.
This exchange from Sherman Alexie's Smoke Signals, released in 1998, gets at the heart of something moviegoers might take for granted, that is, recurring tropes for American Indian characters on screen. I'm Gina Kaufman. Inspired by a film series that kicks off tomorrow at the Nelson, today's Central Standard is an exploration of how a century of cinema has shaped popular perceptions of what it means to be indigenous in America. I'd like to start by introducing this morning's guest. First, let me say hello to Gaylene Krauser. She's with us from the Kansas City Indian Center. Hi, Gaylene. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Gaylene, I have lots and lots of questions about movies, but I want to ask you a terminology question before we go any further. You've expressed a preference for the term American Indian as opposed to Native American. I'll use that terminology throughout this conversation, but could you please explain that preference for our listeners?
The preference is truly a personal preference. There's going to be people that prefer American Indian and people that prefer Native American. My preference is American Indian, partly because that's how I grew up. I've been Indian for a really long time. And also because the treaties that are made with indigenous people are made with the term American Indian. And also because the first time the word Native American, that term was used, was back in the 1850s when it was Protestant people trying to differentiate themselves from immigrants, German and Irish immigrants, and there were some really horrible things going on between those two groups and the original Native American terminology from the 1850s in that context went on to become the Know Nothing Party, and they were very anti-immigration. So knowing that's kind of – that terminology is out there, I just prefer American Indian.
Okay, so we'll use that for the rest of the conversation, but I know different people have different ideas and just wanted to make it clear why we're doing that. My other guest this morning is filmmaker Kevin Wilmot. Confederate States of America earned him widespread recognition in 2004. His more recent film, The Only Good Indian, depicts American Indians in Kansas at the turn of the 20th century. Kevin joins us from KU's Department of Film and Media Studies. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Gina.
Could you give us a synopsis of The Only Good Indian?
Well, The Only Good Indian is about a young American Indian boy who is, you know, is Kickapoo, lives freely with his mother and father. And one day authorities arrive at his house and in essence kind of kidnap him. You know, he's taken away from his family and taken to a boarding school in Kansas. And he is forced to assimilate.
And there is a history of this kind of school.
Yes, the boarding schools, you know, right after the Indian Wars, boarding schools was, you know, came about. And these schools were designed to force the assimilation of American Indians into ultimately white culture.
What inspired you to take on this subject matter?
Well, Tom Carmody wrote the script and produced the film, and Tom and I worked together a lot. And, you know, both of us were always interested in American Indian issues and struggles, and I've always tried to make my films about race in many different ways. And so it just, you know, we're from Lawrence, and, you know, Tom especially grew up, you know, with Haskell. And, you know, so he was very connected to the American Indian community.
So were there pitfalls that you were really deliberately trying to avoid as you went to transform this screenplay into something that would appear on screens before people's eyes?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, when you work with, you know, American Indian actors, one of the things you hear from them, one of the complaints you often hear from them is that they don't get to just be you know, a plethora of different kind of roles. You know, they often only get hired when there's an Indian movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things we wanted to do, we worked with Wes Studi on this film.
And he is a very well-known American Indian actor.
I think he's probably the best well-known. And so we want, you know, with Wes, you know, he's been in a lot of different kind of movies, but often he plays the chief. You know,
yeah,
and he was the chief in what's the Purple People movie, the sci-fi film. I can't think of it right now.
Avatar.
Yeah, Avatar. I'm not a big fan of that film. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
what Wes, you know, Wes, the roles that American Indians often play is, you know. You know, they don't get to play modern people very often. And so we specifically tried to make Sam Franklin's character, you know, in the film, we tried to make Wes's character very much a modern man. So he's already assimilated, and he uses he rides a motorcycle instead of a horse, and he has modern weapons, and he's very much a modern man. He wants to become a Pinkerton agent. And those things in the film, he's kind of given up his Indian self in the film. And the story really is about how this boy who's taken away from his family ultimately kind of affects him to go back and reconnect with his Indian self.
Why is someone who is disconnected from his Indian self an important character to portray?
Well, I think it's a universal story. I think all of us, I certainly could relate to it as an African American. You know, all of us, you know, we are constantly having to be often, as Du Bois called it, two different people. And our two-ness, we have to be kind of our American self and then whatever race we really are. And sometimes those work together really well. Sometimes they pull us apart quite a bit. And so the story really, you know, is about how this man, Sam Franklin, Wes's character, you know, struggles with trying to really kind of be who he really is and at the same time hold on to his true self.
How do you think portrayals of American Indians have changed in Hollywood over time?
Well, it wasn't that long ago that oftentimes people played, you know, American Indians in red face. I mean, that was not that long ago, you know, 80s.
Red face, that's just a painted face on usually a Caucasian.
Exactly. And also, and that changed really with Dances with Wolves. When that film came out, that really changed that. And it also changed with Native Americans, with American Indians speaking their own language in the film, their real language, and not just some mixed, you know, made up, you know, stuff that didn't really, you know, make any sense. And that was typically kind of how it was done. I mean, people would just, I mean, you look at something like F Troop, you know, and you just go, my goodness, that was the norm for a lot of years. And that was considered kind of polite in some ways. And so, you know, it wasn't that long ago that the portrayals were really bad.
The issues raised by Dances with Wolves that's gotten a lot of praise, as you've just indicated, and some criticism, and we'll get back to that shortly. But I want to turn back to Gaylene Krauser. Gaylene, when you think about portrayals of American Indians in the movies, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
The first thing that comes to my mind is that for the most part, Indians have been portrayed as bloodthirsty savages. Heartless kind of people that just are, well, to use the word, on the warpath, as they used it in those films.
Is there an example of that just really captures what you're talking about?
Well, really, any of the Westerns from back in my childhood.
That it's hard to pick one says a lot.
It really is. All of them, up until a certain point in time, up until just in the last few decades, really, that's how they always were. In fact, my mom was telling me a story about how when she was a little girl, somebody asked if she was Indian. And she said yes, but not one of those mean feather-wearing Indians. Even though she knew she was Indian, she saw how they were being portrayed, and she didn't identify with that.
But it sounds like she did think that was a real thing, that she was just a different kind of Indian.
Right.
That's really interesting. I want to talk to you about the idea of not just the American Indian on film, but the American Indian as audience member seeing these films, because American pop culture has such an effect on how we understand each other in this country and sometimes how we understand ourselves.
Right. I completely agree. And I think that's why some of these films that are now out there are so important, because they are changing the dynamic of the way Indian people are portrayed, and primarily because it's Indian people or people that get to know Indian people are making them. Unfortunately, a lot of them aren't the commercial ones that are going to be seen in theaters, but there are a lot of really good ones out there that aren't talking about who we used to be, and in some ways who we still are, but they talk now about modern issues and the fact that we're still here. We haven't gone the way of the dinosaur. We still exist. We still have, we're still human beings.
When you talk about these more contemporary movies, the things that are coming out now that are doing things differently, what are some examples that you might point to?
One of them that I saw recently was The Cherokee Word for Water. And it's a true story about how Wilma Mankiller became the first modern day female chief of the Cherokee Nation. And it was set in the 80s, and it talked about how the community came together to build a water line to a rural Cherokee community, the Bell Water Line. And it's hard for most people, I think, to imagine that people were still without running water in the 1980s. But that was true, and it was a really positive film about an Indian community coming together to do something positive for their community and having that sense of interdependence again.
So in a way, do you think that continuing to go back so much in film and in our narratives to sort of a more distant history, we're ignoring a recent history and current problems that maybe could be addressed in film?
I think actually both of those things need to be addressed. And when I was talking to Krishan McKinney from the Nelson about their film series, I said that, you know, there's a lot of people that don't know reservations still exist in this country. They don't know about the boarding school era, which was important for the film that The Only Good Indian. And the title of that, a lot of people won't know that was a quote from what someone said about the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And then from that, Captain Pratt developed the first kind of military boarding school in the 1870s, because he said the thing was not the only good Indian, it was a dead Indian, but kill the Indian and save the man, which was the formula that they used clear up until the mid-1900s. It wasn't until
very
the,
dehumanizing as a choice of language, if nothing else. Kevin Wilmot, that is the title of your film. Could you talk a little bit more about that title, The Only Good Indian?
Well, one of our American presidents said that, Teddy Roosevelt, who's usually considered to be kind of a progressive guy, but not in this sense. And it's also attributed to General Sherman, who was involved in the Indian Wars. What Galen is saying is that's exactly it. I mean, it's so much of what the boarding school was about was to kind of the forcible change, the forcible altering of people, the forcible removing of their tribal self. You know, that's a horrible thing. You can't imagine someone coming in and trying to strip you of everything that you are, you know, cutting your hair, which is very important to many tribes, stripping of your tribal language. You can't speak your normal language. You know, if you speak your language, you're going to be horribly punished in the school. Adapting to a whole new way of life, stripping your own spiritual self, having to take on a new religion. When I made the film, one of the things that really struck me about it was the fact that, you know, when Galen was talking about how a lot of people don't know about the boarding schools, that's like people not knowing about Jim Crow segregation. I mean, you can't really be an American and understand America and certainly understand Native Americans, American Indians, without knowing about the boarding schools. I mean, it is, you know, Wes Studi, who is the star of the film, he went to a boarding school. His father went to a boarding school. It's only the last few decades that people have not been influenced directly by the boarding schools.
Galen, I want to turn back to you and ask you, in the local Indian community, do people talk about this stuff? Do they talk about, particularly in the movies, the stereotypes, what is represented and what isn't represented?
Absolutely. They talk about, a lot of times they do it in a humorous way and kind of in the introduction, how you were saying, or how you were playing the clip from Smoke Signals. And that's gotten us through a lot of things, is finding humor in so much of that. But it does play a part, and it does affect people, and it does affect people's the way they see each other or the way they felt they're seen. And it's very prevalent in today's society that we're still kind of pigeonholed into a certain stereotype.
Central Standard is going to head to a quick break. When we return, we'll get into some specific movies portraying American Indian characters on screen. You can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined by Galen Krauser of the Kansas City Indian Center and filmmaker Kevin Wilmot. To join the conversation about American Indians on film, call 816-235-2888. That number again is 816-235-2888. And Galen, we were just talking about how people feel seeing different representations of these characters on film. We've talked about stereotypes of American Indians portrayed on film, but what about the stereotype of the white person interacting with this character? How is that relationship typically portrayed?
Well, I think the relationship, depending on the film, a lot of times the relationship, particularly in the older films, and even like with Dances with Wolves, it's always been the person from another race, typically a white person, would come in and kind of save the Indians. And that's kind of been a theme really kind of throughout our history, whether we're talking about missionary schools or in films, there's always been that kind of intent about how we have to save the Indian. And we really just didn't feel like we needed to be saved and kind of still would rather just be able to be who we were created to be without having to be saved.
One other thing that I think is interesting, there is a huge number of tribes in the United States, and I understand that one of the issues for American Indians heading to the movies is that only a couple of these tribes tend to be portrayed on screen. Often it's the Sioux or Lakota. Does it affect other groups to see themselves not represented when references are being made to Indians?
Yes. And sometimes, even when they're portraying another tribe, they will still put them on horseback, whether or not they rode on horses, or put feathers in their hair, whether or not they had feathers. And they always kind of want to put that particular stereotype on every tribe. There's 566 federally recognized tribes, and most of them didn't ride horses or didn't wear feathers. And still, every movie I saw growing up, that's how they were portrayed.
A movie that's come up a lot in talking about this is already Dances with Wolves. So let's talk about that movie a little bit more in depth. We already heard that they're using in that movie an actual Indian language instead of a made-up one. What are some of the other big differences in how that movie approached the portrayal of American Indians? Kevin, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, I think on the positive side of that film is that there are characters, you know, American Indian characters in the film that are three dimensional, that have families, that have children, have a three dimensional life. You know, they're intelligent. They are they're funny. They are full rounded, fully developed characters, and that. I mean, as simple as that sounds, it's pretty rare, especially in a Western. I mean, Westerns are just known for, American Indians. You know, one of the big stereotypes is American Indians on horses on the horizon.
The horizon. Yeah. Why is the horizon such an important thing? That's true. It's often at sunrise or sunset.
Yes. And that was just to depict a threat. That was part of what made the savage stereotype was that, you know, white folks are just, you know, farming and cooking and doing their own thing. And then they turn around and they're the Indians on the horizon. And that always meant one thing. They're coming to get you. And so those type of images are just seared into our movie memory. And, you know, also one of the big ones was with Dance of Wolves, one of the positive ones was, you know, I thought the relationship that Kevin Costner has with I cannot think of his name right now. It's the American Indian actor who is his right-hand man in the film. And that relationship, I thought, was really a pretty great relationship. But, you know, there are negatives as well, which I think the main negative is the fact that, you know, Kevin Costner, you know, in order for that movie to be made, for it to be financed, and it's important to always, I think, talk about, when you talk about images, you have to talk about how movies get made at all. And so it's that movie was made because Kevin Costner is going to be the white man saving the day, and that's the problem.
Another critique I've heard of that movie, and maybe Gaylene, I'll ask you about this, is that some people have said that it's sort of unfortunate that it perpetuates this idea of a vanishing people.
Absolutely, because we're still here, and it does perpetuate that. And I think most movies up until recently have kind of ended with that era of when people, before the reservation era, before the boarding school era, they don't make any movies, or not until recently, about what happened after that. And yeah, it was really sad, and maybe people don't want to see it, but it still happened.
But then I guess one of the things you could say is a positive is that with so many American Indian actors in the film, it makes you aware that there are so many people who are living in contemporary society who are of this background. Do you think that that's a valid positive or?
Well, yeah, I think it is. And we kind of joke that it is kind of like the smoke signals, you know, about Indians watching Indians on TV. We really do enjoy that because it was so rare. You were more likely to see somebody playing Indian, whether it was the guy from the commercials, the environmental commercials in the 70s, he was an Indian. And there was, you know, there were a lot of people that pretended to be and weren't. And so it was really nice to actually see Indian people on TV.
That still happens, though, even very recently. Last year, we had both Benicio del Toro and Johnny Depp filling major American Indian roles.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the things that, you know, one of the stereotypes or one of the kind of just the misnomers out there is, you know, everyone likes to claim they're Native American. And,
yeah, part,
you know,
Cherokee. Everyone's part Cherokee.
Well, you know, and, you know, and so, you know, I guess Johnny Depp was supposed to be an American Indian or partly an American Indian. And he could, I guess, could well be. I'm not going to argue that fact. But he's not known as an American Indian actor.
And he isn't pigeonholed in that kind of role.
Exactly. And that's the thing that I think upsets people a little bit is that, you know, when you're someone like Wes Studi or others that you know, they don't get the call unless they're oftentimes looking for an American Indian actor. Johnny Depp doesn't have to deal with that.
Let's hear from our callers at 816-235-2888. We've got Mike in South Kansas City on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hello. While I was waiting, I thought of something else. Pardon me. What I was just going to mention, not too long ago, I saw a John Wayne movie, a Calvary movie, as they always were, and in his early days, and, you know, the Redskin this, Redskin that, and the other, I don't even remember the other derogatory names. But while I was waiting, I was just thinking, they took Amos and Andy off the TV because it was so derogatory to black people, and it just occurred to me that there's never been an effort to remove the 1930 stereotype of the Indian in a cowboy movie and all those stuff. So that's my comment, and I'm going to hang up and listen.
Thanks for joining the conversation, Mike. What do you guys think about that? Do you think that people would like to see these things not continually rerun on television, or do you think that it's something that people can accept as a relic, or where do communities stand on that?
Well, I don't want to see those movies disappear because I think they are reminders of how far we've come and how far we still need to go. However, I would love to see movies that have horrible stereotypes and bad imagery. I like to have a warning on the beginning of those movies. I don't want words to be removed. I'm a big fan of when the N-word is used in a movie. I want that movie to stay that way.
Why?
Because people need to know why it was used. Maybe it was used in a way to inform people that this is the way it was at this time in history, or sometimes it was used in a derogatory form. Either
Which
way.
We would need to understand about ourselves and our past.
Exactly. And the removing of that stuff, I think, is, you know, but I do think that a warning should be placed on those films, like a warning that, you know, this film was made in this period during, and they, you know, and you should understand where this movie was produced from.
That's a really interesting idea. What do you think, Gaylene?
I would have to agree with him. And I think that in addition to that is having the more modern movies that aren't that way, so that people can educate themselves, because there are tools out there. There are movies out there. There's to be uneducated in today's world is just unbelievable with the internet and everything else and the movies that are available to have. If you don't know about it, it's not because it's not out there and it's not available. But I think we do need to leave things as they were. When we start whitewashing history, we stop realizing why we are where we are. And with things like indigenous languages dying, there's a reason for that. And when you see these old movies and when you see these movies that are made about the boarding school era, then you realize, oh, well, that's why these languages are dying. That's why we have to put extra effort into preserving them, because they were forcibly taken.
That's really interesting, and that's really sad. You know, while you're speaking about language, something I've noticed in the old Westerns is that when they do have these made-up languages that the Indian characters are speaking, the subtitles still translate the English into a broken English. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, don't try to make sense of any of that. I mean, it is – the whole concept of it is so offensive on so many levels that the one thing that is for sure about that is that it was geared toward entertaining the audience and making it easy for the audience to understand the film.
Let's talk to Dan in Midtown. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. How about you?
I'd like to hopefully brief make reference to a couple of different to a movie and a documentary. I love silent movies, and I'd heard about, I can't remember the exact name, it might have been The Iron Horse or some, I don't know, made up Hollywood name. And then the other one is, I think it's a PBS documentary called We Shall Remain, I believe that's the name of it. The old movie, I really had wanted to see, and I finally actually got a hold of a copy of it and watched part of it. I couldn't get through it. It showed these people from Europe on these trains or whatever it was, and they were talking as though this was their country and as though the natives just happened to be there, and then, you know, referring to them as savages and all that rot. And I just, you know, that's just absolute garbage. But I can't remember the name of the movie, but it was horrible. It was horrible.
So that's an anti-recommendation.
Oh. And then the other, recently, PBS, what was it, a couple years ago, they had documentary, I'm sorry, I believe it was 10-part, and it was Native Americans made the movie about their history. There were people from all the various nations. There was the one in, what we now call Virginia, the people that first encountered the people, that tells about the Mohawk Nation, about the various nations, various peoples, and various history, that was very interesting.
Well, thanks. Thank you, Dan. I wonder if we have other documentary recommendations from our panelists.
Sure. There's one out now that kind of talks about some of the issues that are still surrounding Indian people. Particularly this one talks about sovereignty, and it's called Holy Man, USA versus Douglas White. And it's a story about a 70-year-old medicine man from the Pine Ridge Reservation that was accused of molesting his grandchildren. And he was taken to trial and tribal court, and they dismissed the charges for lack of evidence. But a year later, the feds picked it up, and he was tried in federal court and convicted and sentenced to 25 years to life. And so that brings up issues of what brings up a lot of issues. But I think one of the larger ones being that even though we are supposed to be sovereign entities, and we have our own tribal courts, we have our own tribal police, that obviously when the federal government believes that we aren't able to govern ourselves, they can step in and double jeopardy where it would apply to everyone else in the country, does not apply on reservations.
There's a movie that I want to ask you guys about. I'm not positive whether you've seen it, but The Business of Fancy Dancing. Is that one either of you have seen? What about, well, so that's Sherman Alexie. We heard a clip of one of his other movies, Smoke Signals, earlier in the show. Can you talk about that movie or some of these other, the representations that address the complexity of representation?
Well, yeah. I mean, Smoke Signals is just a fun movie. It's a hip movie. And it really, I think, shows a side of life on the res that, you know, people normally don't get to see very often. And they're just young guys and women and a woman, you know, it's very much an indie kind of hip movie. And it just happens to have Native Americans in it, and they get to deal with American Indian issues. And so, you know, that part of it, I think, is what makes Smoke Signals a really, you know, really kind of breakthrough film.
Kevin Wilmot, Gaylene Krauser, can you stay with me for a minute through the break?
Yes.
We will be right back. Central Standard will return, and we'll continue taking your calls, 816-235-2888. Stick around. And we're back. This is Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about portrayals of American Indians in film in the last century or more of cinema from Hollywood. The number, we're getting kind of close to then, so I won't keep giving the number, but I do want to keep talking to Gaylene Krauser of the Kansas City Indian Center and Kevin Wilmot. He's a filmmaker, and he comes to us from KU's Department of Film and Media Studies. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks.
And so we've been talking about some specific movies. Before we do get back to those colors, there are a couple that we haven't talked about, and I just want to run them by you to see if there's something you want to say about them, because they were really big. Last of the Mohicans and Disney's Pocahontas. Anything either of you want to say about either of those films?
Well, Wes Studi, who's in my film, The Only Good Indian, is one of the leads in Last of the Mohicans. And For my money, he plays on the surface could be a bad Indian, you know, the stereotype, the savage. They do one thing in that film that I think kind of redeems his character. He has a scene in the film where kind of unexpectedly he kind of explains his hatred for the people he's been trying to ultimately kill the entire film. And you find out that his wife and child had been killed. And so suddenly it's a really great moment. I mean, it's a really great scene in the film when he talks about this, and it's given a lot of power and substance in the film. And so, you know, that's the thing that you never saw in those early films. You never knew, you know, American Indians were just attacking people because they just wanted to attack. That's what they do.
Yeah. Or like that things just happened to them. They didn't have feelings that could be expressed.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, that's really the difference, I think. You know, the other thing I wanted to say real quickly, you know, that movies like Water should be on TV just as much as The Searchers is on TV. You know, that's the problem, is that the more modern films, you know, that have tried to show these new depictions of American Indians, we don't get to see them as much, but those old depictions still hang around.
What are some of, we talked about a couple of recommendations for really positive or at least nuanced portrayals. Are there any further recommendations either of you want to give? We'll start with you, Gaylene.
Well, I think kind of along the Smoke Signals line, there was a movie back a few years called Skins, and that to me was very poignant, and it really showed some of the issues that are affecting people on reservations now, and everywhere in the country, whether we're Indian or not, is alcoholism and dealing with family members that are not taking care of themselves and finding that way to still love them in spite of their flaws, and being true to yourself. So Skins and Powwow Highway and some of those films really going to give you a look into modern struggles.
Kevin Wilmot, what recommendations might you make?
I want to recommend the documentaries that's going to be at the Nelson, Real Engines.
Be next week.
Yeah, I think it's a really good, it does a really good job of really explaining the stereotypes. And I think a lot of people, they see these things and they don't see it. They don't see it.
They don't see that these are stereotypes.
They don't see the stereotype. I mean, it was so normalized for so many years, especially for us older folks, that, you just don't see it. And, one of my favorite ones is the Searchers, and that movie's often given this kind of, it's been kind of honored as a great Western. But it has a horrible depiction of a Native American Indian person in the film that is pure. He's a pure savage, and he's not given a three-dimensional anything in the film. And and I don't think people that see that film see that. I think that they, the John Wayne characters talked about so much that you miss all these other things that are really despicable.
But the positive recommendation there was Real Engine, which is showing next week at the Nelson on Friday night. And this might sound like a flip question, but it really, I don't mean it that way. Just movies in some ways are fantasy land. So why is it important that historically marginalized people of any group and of any race or ethnicity be represented in new ways and changing ways on screen?
Well, I think stereotypes come out of the fact that we always want to try to pigeonhole people in one form or another. We want to try to label people and put them in a category. And people are just more complex than that. And Hollywood did that in many different ways for money and to honor certain people. These depictions we're talking about now, a lot of these films are coming from actual, American Indian filmmakers. And so this is the first time that's really getting to happen. And so that's a really important thing because now American Indians are telling their own story.
And Gaylene, do you have a quick answer to that question? We just have a second left, but I'd like to get you in on that.
I think it is important that no matter who the race of people or the group of people, that they be able to tell their own story.
Well, Gaylene Krauser, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Kevin Wilmot, thank you.
Thank you.
The film series that inspired this conversation takes place at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art beginning tomorrow evening at 6:30. For details, go to nelsonatkins.org. It's time for Tell KCUR. When we ask you a question and you are our sources, you give us the answers. And for that, as always, we're joined by Allison Rawlitz, the social media producer here at KCUR. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Gina.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this has been a big week for Kansas City, a big couple of weeks for Kansas City. We've seen a lot of success for our sports teams, the Royals in particular. What did we ask people?
Well, Gina, we asked people, what's the craziest thing you've ever done to help the Royals win? And as you just said, the Royals swept the Angels, leaving them just a few wins away from potentially being in the World Series. People are tweeting all over the city. They can't believe that this scenario is even happening. People just don't even understand what's going on.
It has been really miraculous.
It has been miraculous.
But we're going for superstitions and that kind of thing?
Yes. People have been sharing the weird, quirky things that they've been doing to help the Royals get to this point. And we basically took the tack, whatever Kansas City is doing, it's working. So please share that with us.
What did we hear from people?
Well, to kind of kick us off, we sent our intern Lisa Rodriguez to the Kansas City's River Market, and we asked her to ask people in person, and here's what they said.
Just a rally cap, upside down, inside out hat.
So these guys, it's their tradition to either at the stadium buy popcorn, and if they're at home, they'll actually make popcorn if the Royals are losing. And they said it works sometimes, not all the time. Okay. It depends on how well they're doing. Usually when I leave the room, they're doing well, so Maybe I'll just leave the room a little bit extra.
I just went to get a jersey for my doggy because I think that would be good luck for us.
Right now I've been wearing the same Royals shirt and Royals hat for about 3 weeks straight, not washing it every game that I've been to. I went to the wild card, went to the ALDS game.
That was Mike Kay, Scott Gibson, Letty Stegall, and Devin Malloy.
Did Lisa report back to us on how that last guy smelled after 3 weeks in the same shirt?
You know, I didn't ask her that, but I can follow up after this.
So what else did we hear?
I wanted everyone to kind of listen to those responses because they really hit on the two big types of superstitions that we heard back from people. And that's really what people eat on game days and what they eat and what they wear on game days. For instance, Allison Carr says she always drinks Boulevard Pop-Up IPA, and she drank that through all the games, and they won. So she
what
kinda,
a sacrifice.
I know. I'm sure she wasn't the only fan drinking beer either. And then Mitzi on Twitter, she tweeted, yep, four nights of hot dogs and nachos equals four wins for the boys in blue. So she wasn't actually at the games, but she was at home with her children. And she even tweeted a picture of her daughter with this cute little, like, you know, divided plate for kids' food with, like, chips and hot dogs and stuff. It was really fun.
That's it. Again, taking one for the team.
I know. And so those weren't really outrageous, but they were things that, you know, imagine eating hot dogs and nachos four nights all week. And then what people wear, that was a really big thing that came up. Christine on Facebook says she's worn the same shade of blue every day since the Royals got in the playoffs. Now, again, that's not really dramatic, but her response stood out to me because she also has this weird superstition. If the Royals get behind in a game, she sends her husband to the kitchen until they get ahead. So I can only imagine, like, him just hanging out in the kitchen until
how
the Royals are ahead again.
I wonder how he likes it.
I don't know. But he probably keeps on doing it because they keep winning. And then Chris on Twitter, he said, since clinching the WC, I must wear the same shirt unwashed, shoes, hoodie, again unwashed, and the same hat on game days. So that's someone else who's apparently got the same outfit over and over and over again.
The non-washing of clothes is astounding and a little bit alarming, but the effort is appreciated.
Good segue to not washing, because this tradition is not confined to humans. Here's a message we received from an anonymous caller on our Tell KCUR line talking about how a Labrador puppy also plays a big part in game day superstitions.
I live in Prairie Village, and we have a cute 2-year-old puppy, and we put a blue bandana on him when the Royals started kind of sniffing the playoffs. He is adorable in it, but he has been wearing it for a long time. It needs to be washed, and he needs a bath. But he has not taken it off ever since they started their winning spree, and it has been fantastic.
I love that he says the dog doesn't take it off, like as though it's the dog's choice.
There also were a few things that people don't do, Gina. And it was all...
Oh, yeah, abstaining.
Yeah, abstaining. Things. Like things that they don't do as far as superstitions. Lauren on Facebook says she won't stay awake. Like she actually goes asleep after the eighth inning to make sure the Royals win. And she said that works like every time last week. We have this gentleman who called us and talked about how he just won't watch the Royals play. And that seems to be working for him.
What I do is I don't watch the Royals play. If I want them to win, that's the best thing I can do because every time I try to watch a game, they lose. So go Royals.
What's the craziest thing we heard back?
Well, we did ask, what is the craziest thing? And we have a Tell KC source network where people could fill out an online form. And Andy Berry wrote us about how he actually had dirt from the 1985 World Series that the Royals won. He said someone there was on the field scooping up dirt. He asked for some, and all these years he's kept it in this commemorative World Series cup. And then I'm going to quote him now. He says, this year when I was able to get a ticket to the wild card game, I brought my bag of dirt to the stadium. Before the game began, I leaned over the rail and sprinkled some of this 1985 World Series dirt on the field. And of course, we ended up winning. And it doesn't stop there, Gina. He actually goes on saying that he didn't get a chance to see Kansas City against the Angels, but his sister got a ticket. And so she took some of his dirt and sprinkled it on the field. And I know, it's mind-boggling. And then he actually has a plea that I'm kind of sharing with Kansas City.
Go for it.
He says he's not going to have a chance to go see Kansas City face Baltimore. And so he's asking if anyone will be willing to spread his magic across the field for him and keep this tradition of winning going.
Wow, that's cool. How should people reach out to us if they're willing to take on this challenge?
Well, of course, you can tweet us and you can use the hashtag TellKCUR, or you could just go ahead and email us at social@kcur.org and we'd be happy to pass that along to Andy.
I'm kind of worried about what happens when he runs out of dirt.
I know. And I really, how much dirt is this?
Thanks so much, Allison. It's been a pleasure talking to you, as always.
Thank you, Gina.
And I hope the Royals keep winning. What about you?
I hope they keep winning, too.
That's Allison Rollitz, social media producer at KCUR. That's it for today's show. Our guests earlier this hour were Kevin Wilmot of KU's Department of Film and Media Studies and Gaylene Krauser, executive director of the Kansas City Indian Center. Krishan McKinney at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art was also immensely helpful, so thanks to her. Tomorrow is a food show. We'll visit a local organic chestnut farm during the harvest, and the food critics will tell us about the nuttiest foods on Kansas City menus. Join the conversation and share your favorite nut dishes, perhaps a cashew brittle or a walnut pesto, tomorrow at 10. Catch up on all our shows at kcur.org/centralstandard and sign up for our podcast while you're there. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.